Okay, so welcome to week three. Before we start, before we start, thank you to Felicia. She's given us a pre-Shavuot treat, a cheesecake. When you finished, don't forget that if you eat cheesecake today, you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah properly. You still have to eat it on Shavuot.
So,
oh, that's a big topic. There's about 10 reasons. Which one do you want to know?
Anyway.
I'll tell you a quick one just before we start. The word in Hebrew for milk is chalav, right? Actually, I'll tell you two quick reasons. So, the reason for milk is chalav. Chalav has a numerical value of 40. And when God gave us the Torah and Shavuot, Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, went up on the mountain for three sets of 40 days to receive the rest of the Torah and to learn all the details of the law. However, I need to give you another reason that's got to do with cheese, hence the cheesecake, right? Because the mountain of Sinai, we always call it Har Sinai, but actually has many names. In Tehillim, in Psalms, King David calls it Har Gavnunim, the mountain of Gavnunim, which the word Gavnunim is the same word as Gvina, which is cheese. That's one. There you have two quick reasons. Okay. So now you can have two pieces of cheesecake on Shavuot. Or Antonin.
I've got the cheesecake.
Okay. Just a little bit of a review from last week. We talked about, Viktor Frankl talked about the difference between an animal and a human. Animals are driven by instincts and drives of pleasure and so on. Basically, we are the animal is driven by what they must do. And sometimes we are also driven that way if we give in to our animal soul, right? However, humans are not defined, but they're more driven by what they should do, not what they must do, if you know what I'm saying, right? And he talked about the idea that meaning can be found by everyone. He concedes that religion is a good way to find meaning, but there are pathways to meaning in other settings as well. And that's why he says that, given what we just said, like logotherapy is not dominated by the pleasure or power, but dominated by desire and will for meaning. Now we explained that what that means is pleasure and power is always pursued when there's a sense of I. In other words, it's what I want, what's going to be good for me, right? So I take from the outside world what is going to be good for me. Where there's meaning, we actually move away from the I. And we, in his words, we move outward. In other words, we move to connect to something other than ourselves, something higher than ourselves. And that's why we went into the three areas of meaning, which can be found by anyone in any context, but it's also very fundamentally got to do with moving away from the I. And the first one was creative values, which was the deed and to do something, to actually create something, to do something. The other one was experiential values, which can be even experiencing something outside of ourselves when there's no other thing to do. For example, his story of observing the sunset in the concentration camp. But more importantly, it's got to do with experience someone else, to experience a relationship, but not selfishly, selflessly, to true love, selfless love, where we're actually moving outwards to the other person. And then he talked about attitudinal values, which is finding meaning when necessary, even in challenge, even in suffering, which is, we'll talk about that a bit more today as well. Now, before we go on to today's topic, or topics actually, I just want to talk about two things. The first is we are, as you know, many of you have already participated. We are currently running our raffle, our annual raffle. By the way, if anyone of you get a call from Israel, it's not some scammer. It's a girl that's doing some work for us in Israel, and hence the Israeli number. So it's safe to call back. But it is an important raffle. It's an important fundraiser that covers not the whole, but a little portion of our yearly budget. So I urge everyone to try and participate. If you've already participated, try and participate again. Buy a little bit more than last year if you can, but let's make it happen. Let's make it really good. It goes for another month until the end of June. Also, in 2 weeks' time, you can talk to the office if that's easy for you, or you can do it online. 2 weeks' time, we are doing a special event. I did mention it briefly, but in the next 2 weeks, I'll remind you many times. And we are doing a special event with the author. I don't know if you remember, but at the beginning of the year, we did two series, actually. based on this book, Letters for Life. I know many of you enjoyed the series, and there's a lot of good things, but the author is coming out to Sydney and to Melbourne, and I got a call from a guy that's managing his tour, and he said, "Do you want to have him?" I said, "Yes, if I get him the first." I wanted the Binner to have the first. So we do have the first. He's coming in. Let's just daven that it works out, because he's actually arriving very early on Thursday morning, and he's coming straight here. So,
Is that the 12th?
Yeah.
Who's the author?
Sorry?
The author
of this. His name is Levi Shmatkin. This is a picture of him.
Yeah.
Shmatkin. Yeah, it's pretty phonetic spelling. Anyway, he'll be here. I'm going to interview him. We're going to have a discussion about the book and about some of the content that's in the book. What he did was he spent years collecting letters, stories, anecdotes from the Lubavitcher Rebbe's writings and experiences and so on, and developed such an unbelievable solid concepts in terms of being emotionally strong and the different challenges that we have. So that will be in 2 weeks' time. We're actually going to start at 9 because we're also going to have a coffee cart to make it a bit more enjoyable, and it's winter, so it's nice. It'll be nice and warm. So you can get coffee from 9 or even a bit before 9, from a quarter to 9 maybe. But and then we'll wait till about 20 past and then we'll start the interview. It should be enjoyable. So take a flyer when you finish. All details are here. Spread it around and let's have a beautiful morning. Okay. So what I want to do today is actually touch on 4 smaller topics. The first one is a bit bigger, but touch on 4 topics that Viktor Frankl discusses in some of the interview that I mentioned before and some of the various YouTube clips. And those 4 topics are all things to enhance. So last week we talked about what is meaning, but to live a life of meaning, these things are important, and they motivate, I guess, the will and the desire to actually live with meaning. I'll just tell you quickly what those 4 topics are, and then we'll dive in. So the 4 topics are faith, indoctrination, potential, and the eternity of meaning. So let's begin with faith. So Viktor Frankl, in some of the panels, talks about faith. And I think the faith that he talks about is so important when it comes to living a life with meaning, particularly the meaning that he described last week, which is the meaning in challenge, the meaning in suffering, right? But generally speaking. So there's a panel where he was interviewed. It was connected to the Holocaust. It was in the 70s, I think. And he says some very powerful things there, which I think are connected, as I said, to meaning, especially the attitudinal meaning. And but it's in general, because meaning, as we said, means moving away from self to something higher than self, right? So all forms of meaning, faith propels that, because when you have faith, there's an absolute power, an absolute thing that that we believe in and we want to connect to. And therefore, that's all the more so we are motivated and driven when we have faith to live a life of meaning. So, he says a number of things. First of all, he talks about the numbers issue. Very, very powerful point that he makes. I wouldn't go there if it wasn't for him, but he's an authority on lots of things. So, he says that faith has nothing to do with how big something is, right? He says, because obviously the question that was asked, the question he's always asked about faith after the Holocaust. And also I want to mention, obviously, that we never judge anyone for what people went through, and maybe their faith was damaged or became worse or whatever the case is. That's not for us to judge. But he does say an interesting thing. He says, if you take the suffering of one individual or one child, right? It's the same question. In other words, the question on faith has really nothing to do with how big the challenge is or how big the suffering is, right? Because he doesn't say this part, but we don't want any suffering. Any suffering is a question. If one single person suffers for reasons that we can't understand, it's exactly the same question. Because it's big, it doesn't actually make it a bigger question. Very interesting point. And he says, therefore, faith is an absolute thing. Faith in God, in his words, is unconditional. And therefore must be in every circumstance. Because faith, essentially, we talked about this a lot, right? Is that I don't understand. Faith is that there's a bigger plan which I can't comprehend. But I believe there's a plan. I believe God knows what he's doing. So it makes no difference if it's small or big. And therefore it's necessary. It can be challenged with any form of numbers. And it can be strengthened and it can be strong no matter what the circumstance is. Right? And then he quotes Job. So Job is a book in Tanakh about a person that had tremendous success and then tremendous, tremendous suffering. And it's a journey. Job is a journey where at the end he comes to the conclusion that he has to have faith. And he doesn't understand the reason of his decline in every area of his life. And Job says, I shut my mouth, essentially saying to God, you know better. You know better. I surrender to you, right? And that's a thread, of course, which follows through in every Jewish experience. He makes a very interesting point. And again, I'm quoting him. I'd be a little bit scared to talk about this, but this is the words of Viktor Frankl. And he says, in his experiences, there definitely are exceptions. I mean, I have to say, I've heard this from people as well. But he says, in his experience, talking to many, many people of his peers or people that have gone through the Holocaust and so on and so forth, he said, in his experience, people that had very strong faith before, it actually sometimes got stronger, which is fascinating. It got stronger. Didn't get weaker, got stronger. I guess because while they were experiencing what they were experiencing, they had deep faith, and the only thing that kept them going was stronger faith. Now, I've seen this. There's a particular rabbi in America. He's now over, it's over 19 actually. And he was a child in the concentration. He was confronted by Mengele. And he tells of the amazing miracles actually that happened to him during the Holocaust. But he saw unimaginable things. And he said his faith got really, really strong. In fact, he tells the story about he was once going, because he was a child, right? So he was a relatively young man, and he was confronted, a religious guy, and he was very connected to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He became a follower of his afterwards. And he was here once, and he was telling a story that he was confronted by all kinds of questions about the Holocaust, and a thing, which is obviously legitimate questions, but it was from someone that hadn't gone through the Holocaust. And he was, but he saw religious Jews, so it was the years where, you know, the Holocaust wasn't that, I mean, I think with the same thing we sort of can apply to what's going on today on a different level, but he was confronted and he was really challenged. So he rolled up his shirt and he showed him that he talked to someone that's done this. And yet his faith was so strong and got stronger. So he says, this is the experience that he has, right? This is connected to something I once saw in the name of Rabbi Jacobowitz, the previous chief rabbi of England. And he said a beautiful thing about one of the verses in Tehillim, where King David says, "Lahagid ba'boker chasdecha," I want to be able to tell and relate and communicate your kindness in the morning, the emunatcha ba'leilot, and your faith at night. And he explained a beautiful thing. He says, "What does this mean? Morning kindness." And he says that when one can talk about faith, and experience faith, and connect to faith, and strengthen faith by boker in the morning. Morning means when it's clear, when it's bright, when things are going well, when it's chasdecha, when it's your open kindness. The more we strengthen that, then there can actually be emunacha ba'leilot. There can be faith at night also. Night means when things are dark and right. So it's a really important thing to talk about faith and to strengthen faith, not only when we need to, but even when we don't need to. Even when things are going fine and like we don't necessarily need to talk about faith that much, that's when we need to talk about it, and that's when we need to strengthen it so that when things don't go so well for us, it doesn't become weakened, it becomes stronger. And I say talk about it even when things are going well. You know the famous joke about the guy looking for a parking space, right? And he's really busy and there's a lunchtime meeting and he can't find one, and it's really urgent, and he starts making a deal with God. He says, if you give me a parking space, I'm going to put up a mezuzah, I'm going to give extra tzedakah. And he starts one mitzvah and he keeps on adding the pledge that he makes to God, and suddenly this beautiful parking place appears and he says to God, don't worry, I found one. Right, so, Rabbi Sachs, in a different interview, and he also talks about, he says that when he visited Poland, he met and spoke to Holocaust survivors, and some of them told him that they, during the time of challenge, during the time in the camps, they felt that God was personally with them. Amazing thing, right? Amazing experience. Now, how can that be? So it really also comes from Tehillim. It comes from Psalms, where King David says, Imo, he talks about how God listens to us, and he talks to us, he has a relationship with us, he saves us, and then suddenly he throws in the middle of all this, King David, I forgot which chapter it is, but he throws in, Imo anachi b'tzara, that God is with me in my challenge. He's hugging me, he's close to me. And that's what faith is really there. Faith is that God always has a relationship with us. And he's always close to us, and he's maybe even more close to us when we're going through difficult times, even though we don't want those times and we don't understand what he's doing, but he's always with us. And that's what emunah is. And that's the point Viktor Frankl says, that faith is something that is unconditional and is something that can strengthen even in time of challenge. And there's the famous story where Viktor Frankl tells us in his famous book, Search for Meaning, Man's Search for Meaning, where when he came to the camps, you know, he came to the camps with nothing, but he took with his manuscript, and the manuscript was his theory of logotherapy, which he had written before the war. Right? And to him, that was the most important possession that he had. And the Nazis stripped him of everything, and they undressed him. With that was his manuscript that went, and he felt, how's he going to go on without that? That was his whole mission, that was his whole goal, to be able to spread those ideas. And then they gave him some old clothes, some other prisoners, whatever the case was, and he put it on, and finally he feels in his pocket a piece of paper. And he looks and he sees that it's a piece of a siddur. And the piece of the siddur, the page from the siddur, the prayer book, was the words, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. He tells the story himself. Right? And he thought to himself that now, he says, I have to live by what I was teaching before the war. It's important to know, logotherapy didn't develop after the war. It was disseminated after the war. But it was already there before the war. With great difficulty, Viktor Frankl had veered, he'd gone away from the Freudian approach, and it was becoming a thing already. But he says, now is my time to live with what I thought, right? He's so committed to this theory, and now when he saw that sign, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, his faith was strong, and he was able to live by that theory even during the war, even in the camp. And it's interesting, when you talk about faith getting stronger, you know, faith is an intrinsic DNA. It's a Jewish DNA. We all believe. We have a soul. And we believe whether we think we do, whether we think we don't, how much we do, but it's really ingrained and it just needs to blossom sometimes. And I saw this in Israel. I spoke to a soldier, one of the soldiers I spoke to, that I chatted with, he tells me, you should know, he said, Yeshit orurut shel emunah achshav. He says, there's an amazing awakening of faith going on now. He was telling me this, right? That's one of the many times I realized that I didn't come to Israel to lecture other people. Like, we came to receive strength, not to give strength. Anyway, so why is that all relevant to us? Because it is. Because when either collectively we go through a difficult time, faith or personally, emunah faith is really what allows us, as it did to him in the concentration camp, it allows us in whatever form of challenge we're going through to strengthen our emunah and therefore to allow us to actually find meaning. Why? Because we realize that there's a purpose to everything. I've said this to you before. I don't see how you could, I mean, I suppose you could, but I don't see how without faith you can find meaning and challenge. Because if suffering is just a random curveball, then it's just random and it's like, okay, so maybe I can be resilient and I can become strong. But when you have faith, even in times of challenge, you realize there's a plan here. There's something happening. There's something here that I could experience a purpose in. I can make it purposeful. I can make it meaningful. Because of faith. So faith propels and faith motivates that sense of purpose, that sense of meaning. That's why it's so important. Before we go on, I do want to just interrupt because, you know, I love the Jewish calendar. So I want to just talk about Shavuot for a minute because this is so relevant and so connected. So Shavuot, we talk about receiving the Torah. That's 3,337 years ago, to be exact. That's when we stood at in a few days, that is. That's when we stood at Mount Sinai, right? These years are documented. It's like, you know, because we count from the creation of the world. This was year 2448. Now we're 5785. So that's 3,307 years ago. And the Jews stood. All the Jews, about 3 million of them, including, we are taught, all the future souls, stood at Mount Sinai. Souls of everyone that was to come. Souls of people that converted to Judaism. Everything. All souls were there, listening to God reveal Himself on Mount Sinai, tell us the Ten Commandments, and give us enter into relationship with us. Now, sometimes people think that the giving of the Torah Mount Sinai was just about giving us a bunch of laws, a bunch of instructions, or giving us the ability to study Torah in future generations. It's all of that, but it's not really that. Because actually knowledge of Torah was there before Mount Sinai. We know Abraham studied Torah, Isaac, Jacob, they all had knowledge of Torah that was to come. But it wasn't ours, and it wasn't a sense of ownership. And also, there wasn't that deep relationship with God. Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, was the revelation of God taking us as a nation. In fact, in the Talmud, it's referred to as a wedding between God and the Jewish people, right? The chuppah. Now, one of the famous phrases, one of the very, very famous phrases that is around the story of Mount Sinai was when God brought the knowledge that he was going to choose us and there's going to be a revelation, and Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, gave us over that concept, we responded, Na'aseh v'nishma. Na'aseh v'nishma. Meaning, we will surrender, we will do, even before we understand. Right? So we'll do, and then we'll explore. In other words, we're not going to do our due diligence about every mitzvah, if it makes sense or not. We're just going to accept. We can accept, and we're going to, and then we'll understand. Not that understanding isn't important. After all, it's the giving of the Torah. We're talking about Jewish wisdom, right? I earn a living by promoting Jewish wisdom and understanding. So it's an important thing, right? Very, very important, because God wants us to internalize. But the foundation is that na'aseh, that we will do. And the Talmud says, midrashically, the Talmud says, that when the Jews proclaimed na'aseh v'nishma, this was the day before Shavuot, a day before they got the Torah, 600,000 angels came down and placed on every Jew two crowns. One crown for na'aseh, one crown for nishma. I'm assuming it means a spiritual crown, because I'm not sure there's place for two crowns on a person's head, but he gave us two crowns, one for na'aseh, one for nishma. And the question is, what's the imagery of a crown? So the concept that's talked about in mystical teachings is this, and this is so connected to faith and surrender and understanding that there's something higher than ourselves that we can't comprehend fully. The human being, the structure, the physical build of the human being, we know mirrors the 10 powers of the soul, right? We've talked about this before. So emotions in the heart, but more specifically, the right hand is chesed, the left hand is gevurah, the right leg is netzach, chod, and so on, right? So and the head, we know, is the seat of intellect, right? Intellect being the highest tool or the highest conscious tool that the human being has. It's a conscious tool that we have to be objective, to look at, to understand morality, to explore morality, and ultimately to make decisions between wrong and right. The idea of bechira, the idea of free choice. All true. And then there's the keser, there's the crown that we have. The crown means something that transcends the head, higher than the head, because it's not rational, it's not logical. And that's when Jews said, na'aseh v'nishma, they demonstrated they were ready for this journey. They demonstrated they were ready for this experience. They were able to internalize that the receiving of the Torah is not about understanding our relationship with God, it's about an unconditional bond with God. It's unconditional faith, an unconditional relationship, which, by the way, goes two ways. God is unconditionally connected to us as well, which is why when we come Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, no matter what we've done, we can always fix, because God is ultimately unconditionally connected to us. But it goes both ways, and it's based on the idea that we are unconditionally related to Him and committed to Him. And that's na'aseh v'nishma, and that's we've got two crowns. The crown of na'aseh and the crown of nishma. The obvious question is, why a crown on nishma? Nishma means to understand. Nishma means to learn. But the concept is that even the learning needs to be in the context of that faith. Right? When we learn God's Torah and we learn His principles, we don't pick and choose. We don't say, this I understand, this I don't understand, so I'm going to reject, and so on and so forth. We are unconditionally committed to the axioms of truth and the foundations of the Torah, both in the experience of just surrendering and in the experience of nishma. Why? Because it's all got to do with our basic intrinsic DNA of emunah, of faith. And when we are connected that way, then we understand that we need to grow. We understand we need to connect to something higher. We need understand that we need to accept even the things we can't understand, and accept therefore that no matter what happens to us in life, there's a way to instill meaning and purpose by connecting to Him, right? And that's why faith is so important. I just saw a clip, a very interesting clip the other day. Someone sent me. of a person telling a story of his encounter with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he says that he once had an audience with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he said to him, he said, "I don't understand all the mitzvot of the Torah." He says, "Does God really care? Like, does he care exactly, like, if the mezuzah is in the top third of the door or the bottom? Does he really care? Like, all the details, right? I mean, the truth is, being blunt and honest, there are a huge amount of details, right? In every mitzvah, if you have a lulav and an etrog, I know we shake it on Sukkot, but if you know what goes into it, I mean, there are so many laws, right? Exactly what the etrog has to, there are certain things, blemishes that can invalidate an etrog, how to build a sukkah, what are the laws of building a sukkah, how high, how wide, what makes it kosher, what makes it... Well, he said to the Rebbe, "Does God really care? Like, does it matter to him if it's like this or like that?" And the Rebbe answered, he said, "You're making a mistake," he said. "It's not about him, it's about us. In other words, God wants a relationship with us. And he provides us with the tools of how to have a relationship with us. Now, not of it all we can understand, but God said, this is an expression of me. The way I'm giving it to you, the halachot, the laws, the detail, the specifics, are actually, it's like the wiring." You see a lot of wiring going on now over here? Right, it's like the wiring. And I've said this to you before, if you put the wire in the wrong, you know, like me, when I look at wiring, I look at a Christian, I don't know what's going on. There's a red wire, there's a yellow wire. To me, what's the difference? Put the yellow one there, put the yellow one there. Red, no, but it doesn't work like that. If you put the red wire or the yellow wire, the green wire in the wrong place, the whole thing blows up. And it doesn't work. The lights won't go on. So God is giving us a wiring system. He says, this is how it works. Not because I care, but because that's your pathway to connect to me, to have a relationship with me. It's the same idea. Do we understand all of it? No. We can try. We can understand the best we can. And God wants us to understand. And he wants us to explore. And he wants us to analyze. But at the end of the day, it's about that emunah, about that faith. And this is something that we need to work on. It's not an easy thing. The relationship that we have between us and God, which expresses itself very strongly on Shavuot. You know, Shavuot says the Torah was given on a mountain, right? Mount Sinai. Why a mountain? There are many reasons. But one of the reasons is because God said, "I'm coming down to you. I'm coming to you. But actually, I'm not coming to you all the way because you need to put in the work also. You have to go up." And he says, Moshe Rabbeinu, he called to Moses and says, "Alei el Hashem, go up the mountain." Because to really have a relationship, you can't rely on him to do all the work. We have to do some of the work. And that's why he gave us the Torah, and he gave us that moral code, and he gave us that guide, and he gave us the mitzvot, and he gave us the wisdom. And he said, you need to put in work, you need to invest. And that's how you create the meaning, that's how you create the way to connect higher, and that's why you create the relationship. So this goes back to this is about Shavuot a little bit, and of course every year we can reconnect to that experience. As I say, every single festival we don't celebrate history, we re-experience history, and that's why every Shavuot we need to try and connect to that strength and that greatness of understanding that it's happening again. Every year God gives us the Torah once again, and we need to try and connect to it and stand at Har Sinai and once again strengthen our faith and get that crown, that part that transcends our logic, that transcends the rationale, by saying Naaseh V'Nishma. So that's the concept of faith, and Viktor Frankl talks about faith in relation to meaning and how important it is. The second topic is an important one, but I'm just going to go over it very quickly. In this interview that I've been referring to the last few weeks, he says he has a bit of a go at the, nothing's changed, but he has a bit of a go at the interviewer. He says, the media, he obviously is intimating that the media has a lot to do with what's happening. And he says the following, he says, "And it depends whether or not you are exposed to indoctrination. An indoctrination to the effect that man is nothing but a mechanism. That man is nothing but an outcome of conditioning." Right? "If you indoctrinate people along these lines, small wonder if they are purged from any enthusiasm or idealism." Right? And I'm just mentioning that because it's something we have to be very aware of. We are bombarded more than in Viktor Frankl's time. Today we are bombarded by philosophies. We are bombarded by perspectives. And it's very easy to buy into them. I don't want to get political, but you know when I saw this and it really hit me? And I was wondering how in previous history this could happen. I saw it during COVID. How we all just followed. We all followed, and when it was over, now we start asking questions, right? But it was incredible. People were dobbing each other in. People, right? This was the society. Why? Because we got told stuff, right? And the same has happened since then. And so much garbage being put out there, and The media puts it out, and outlets put it out, books put it out. That we read stuff, it sounds good, the person says it well, and we start to subtly, subconsciously, sometimes consciously, we start to believe it, right? And part of what's being put out today is the move away from meaning. Put out by sometimes really great people, people who write beautifully, people who are now considered great leaders in personal growth, and so on and so forth. And what they're doing, step by step, chipping away at our sense of meaning and just making us meaningless. And that everything's about pleasure and about self and about... And we have to be very careful. Not everything society says is authentically true, right? The Talmud has a very interesting little... And it's a more halachic thing, but it has a very interesting lesson. There are certain animals or certain birds that even if they shecht it properly, they might still be not kosher. Because if the animal has a certain disease or has a puncture in the lung or a chicken has something wrong with it or... I remember watching my mother, she used to... Not shech, but she used to open the chicken herself sometimes and salt it. And one of the things I used to observe her doing, I learned that I do it from her, that we take out the pupik. You know what the pupik is? The, I don't know what you call it in English. Huh? Yeah, some, we take out the, well, it's not a belly button, it's the, yeah, the stomach, in other words, right? Which we then used to put in the chicken soup on Friday night, by the way. She used to peel it off and make sure there's no holes there because sometimes a chicken can eat a needle and it can puncture the stomach and that could even render the chicken not kosher even though it was slaughtered properly. So there's one particular thing where the Talmud discusses a particular condition and he's not sure if that chicken is viable or not and if it's kosher or not. So, and it's still alive, but we're aware of that disease. We want to know if we can slaughter and eat it because it might not be actually a kosher chicken or a kosher duck. I think I'm forgetting exactly what the scenario is. So the Talmud says you have to test it. How do you test it? You have to put it in a stream of water that has a current and see if it can swim against the current. If it can swim against the current, then it's kosher. So that's a good lesson. Sometimes we need to know if we can stream. Socialization, social pressure, social norms, social philosophies are very strong and we shouldn't undermine them. And sometimes we need to look at ourselves, are we just following or are we looking for real meaning? Godly meaning, truth, real truth, the way God gives us the truth. Can we swim against the current? And that's a sign of being kosher. Okay. The third idea that is so important when it comes to finding a life of meaning is potential, looking at our potential. Why? Because our default position, this is the complexity of the human being. Our default position, consciously at least, is to live a life empty of meaning. That is the condition of the human being. Because we have a very strong animal soul, very strong animalistic drives. The soul is more hidden than the animal soul. In fact, the default position of a child is much more central than the animal soul. That's why children are completely egocentric. The only thing is with them it's normal and it's supposed to be that way. But then we have to grow out of it and fight it and rise above it and look for meaning. Look for meaning means going outwards. There's resistance to that. We are wired for personal survival, which is good, but not good when it's translated in pursuit of materialism and pleasure and power and things like that, right? So we have to understand one of the things that we're looking for meaning and wanting to live a life of meaning. That as we said the first week, it will require a sense of purpose. It will require learning. It will require a willingness to sacrifice and a willingness to work hard. Meaning doesn't come easy. Live a life of meaning, really to connect to something outside of us, whether it's in relationships, whether it's something experiential, whether it's attitude to suffering, or whether it's living a godly life. All of those forms of meaning, or all them put together or separate from each other, require work. And part of that work begins, as he says it, as Viktor Frankl says it, we need to understand our infinite potential. Part of being so consciously driven by the animalistic part of us, we often lock ourselves into beliefs that we can't do certain things, and we can't grow, and we can't find meaning, and we can't break our personality. Often finding meaning means going beyond what we used to. Or even beyond what we wire to do, beyond our personality. It might mean helping someone when you're not interested, when you're not the kind of person. It might be exploring a mitzvah when you're not, it doesn't talk to you, or whatever it is, right? So he says the following. I want to read this to you because it's so beautiful. He says the following. He says, he's challenging the interview, and he says, and also you think low, you think small of man, you see. What is necessary to think great of man? At my age, he said like this, at my age of 72, that's when he was 72 when this interview took place, now a couple of years ago, I started taking flying lessons. Victor Frankl decided he wants to take flying lessons. Whenever I was in California, and once my flight instructor told me, listen to this, it's a very beautiful analogy. He says, if there's a rule in flying, I don't know much about flying, but this is what I'm believing what he says here. He says, if you are starting here and you wish to land there, and you have a crosswind condition, you will fall prey to the drift and land south of that place. In other words, you'll fall short. Right? So you have to aim for a compass direction beyond the place that you get, of your destination, north of where you're landing. You have to embark on what we pilots call crabbing. I don't know what they mean. And then he says, and the same with man. If you see man only that high, you are corrupting him. He will deteriorate. He will become worse. He will drift, as it were, morally. But if you think of him high, then you make him arrive where he can be. In other words, if you take man as he is, we make him worse. On the other hand, if we take him as he should be, we help him become what he can be. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah. Rabbi, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Victor. I'm sure I'm speaking for everyone in the room. But that is one of your single greatest gifts that you give us, is it not? That Rabbi will always see us better than we are and pitch us higher. Right. Exactly what Victor Frankl says, you do.
We try. Thank you. But I just thought that was put, I know we've talked about this before, but I thought it was just put so beautifully. If we take him as he should be, we'll help him become what he can be, right? Now, the truth is, thanks for the compliment, but I actually learned it from my mentor, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who, as I've told you many times, was a person, I've seen many videos of him talking to people on those famous Sunday dollars and all those kind of things. And he had that almost paradox, but it's not a paradox at all. It comes exactly from this. Because he would be very tolerant, very compassionate, very embracing, very welcoming, very non-judgmental, and yet be very demanding. The people would come to him, you never came to him. If you said anything to him, you always came away with homework to do more than you'd done till now. Right? And it wasn't a paradox at all, but actually one came from the other. It was because he never saw a person how they were. It could be the most secular person, the most, whatever it could be. It could be a gangster. It doesn't matter, right? When anyone showed up, he looked at his soul. That's the truth. And he saw him for what he's capable of being. That's the thing, you see. And this is, I think, what Victor Frankl was talking about here also. And because he saw him that way, the way he demanded wasn't in a judgmental way at all. It was, I see you for so much more than you see yourself. And therefore, you are capable of so much more. And that's critical if we want to live a life of purpose and meaning. Because we have to be willing to go beyond what we think is ourself. Now, it is ourself, consciously. Our limitations, our boundaries, our lack of what we think we can do is all to do with our animal soul, which is our consciousness. Consciously, we operate on our animal soul most of the time. But if we connect deeper to our soul, and we understand that we have a soul that is infinite, right, infinite. And that soul is, why is it infinite? Because at the core of our soul is a godly spark, and God is infinite. And therefore infused us with a sense of infinity. That we need to know that really we can be so much higher than we are. Now, doesn't mean that today we can reach that ultimate destination. But that's what we have to aim for, like the plane. And then we'll aim at a higher place than we are now. As he says, if we take him as he should be, we help him become what he can be. Okay? So that's the third thing. Finally, the fourth thing is eternity. And this is such an important thing. We have spoken about this before, but I want to, because he speaks about it, and I want to bring it out the way he does, and it's so important. And it's part of this interview as well. He was really challenged in this interview. And the interviewer says to him the following. He says, it seems to me for man to be fully alive, he has to find the kind of meaning that you're talking about. And yet, he says to Viktor Frankl, there are people who go through life feeling, well, I can make out this, well, I can make out in this life, I can exist in this life, I can make do because there's an afterlife and there's something better. In other words, interesting thing, right? You can have a religious perspective and say, well, if that's the case, this world is nothing. It's a better place afterwards, right? I'm just going to exist. I'll have a good time here. And then, you know. So Frankl answers very beautifully, and he says the following, which is in line 100% with a very, very important Jewish idea. And it's so important for us to internalize. And therefore, even if we've discussed it before, it's important to repeat it. He says, everything is transitory. So what do we mean? What's going to remain? He says, but then meaning will remain. He says the following. And as I always say, says Viktor Frankl, what is transitory are only the potentialities, are only the opportunities to fulfill meaning, be it by doing something, loving someone, whatever the meaning is, right? But once we have actualized such a transitory potentiality, we have used the opportunity in life to find meaning through the deed, through the experience, whatever it is, then we have rescued all this meaning. We have rescued it into the past. We have safely delivered it and deposited it into the past. And no one can deprive and rob us of what we have put into the past. The deed done, the loved, the suffering honestly gone through with meaning, all that stuff, he says, is completely eternal. And then he goes back to the story of Job. And he says what he learns from there is that the past is the safest form of being. It might be over in the past, but everything remains. We have eternalized everything. What he's saying is as follows. That although this life might come to an end, although, extending this concept, right? Although we might live for a meaning today and then go back to emptiness tomorrow. Because we don't always fulfill this, right? His point is that actually a life lived without meaning, that's a life that disappears. That's a life that is gone. A life lived with meaning is eternal. Because when you create meaning, that meaning is there. And it's eternally there. Now I said this is so in line with Jewish thought. And let me just share 2 points with you. One is something we've done in the past, but it's got to do with the story in the Haggadah, where there's a great sage, Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah, who says that I am like 70 years, is the phrase there in the Haggadah, I'm like 70 years. What's the story behind that phrase? Because there was a whole story in the high court in the Sanhedrin, they needed a new leader, and he was the only one that was eligible. He came from the right lineage, he was the right knowledge, he was the right person, and he needed to become the leader, the chief judge of the Sanhedrin. He only had one problem. He was 18 years old. Right? And God performed a miracle. He didn't know what he should do. He consulted with his wife. It was a whole discussion. And a miracle happened overnight that he looked older. He looked 70 years old. I mean, he looked like he had the reverence, the respect of an older person. Right? And then he says in the Haggadah, you know, there's a particular law I've been trying to push through, a particular interpretation, and people are resisting and opposing me, which would result in a particular halakha of how we say the Shema and so on. And he says, I'm like 70 years old and I haven't been able to persuade them. Until a colleague of mine came and he highlighted a particular verse in the Torah that sided with the way I was interpreting it, and that was good. So the obvious question is, well, your answer is in your beginning phrase. Your answer is because you're not 70 years old. That's why. You might look like 7 years old, but you're not 7 years old. You don't have the experience. And therefore, that's why you weren't able to persuade your colleagues. But Kabbalah gives an answer that's not like that. The reason he said that is because he wasn't physically 7 years old, but God made him look like 7 years old. Now, what was the point of that? That was like a stunt. So it's got to do Kabbalistically with an idea like this. That we believe in Jewish wisdom, we believe in reincarnation, we believe in Gilgal, that a soul comes back. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was the Gilgal, he was the reincarnation of Samuel the prophet. A great prophet. Samuel the prophet, Shmuel HaNavi, lived for 52 years. And his neshama was in Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was now 18, so he was like 70. Which means an interesting thing. It means that sometimes, going back to potential, right? It means sometimes we're a lot older than we think. In a good way. We have more strength, we have more experience, we have more spiritual power than we think, because we're actually, especially nowadays, we've come through so many cycles, we actually have the power and the spiritual of my soul that was here before. And those people, all the good they did. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe, in his commentary on the Haggadah, asks a very important question. He says, well, that's great news for Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. But who says it's great news for us? If we carry the baggage, or we carry the power, the experiences from our previous reincarnation, maybe the person who I was, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, he was Samuel the prophet. But I don't know, maybe the guy I was is like, that's such a good guy. Right? I don't want to carry his baggage. I don't want his stuff left over for me. Right? Maybe the terrible things in his life. So that's not good news for me. It might be good news for him, but not for me. And he answered the most phenomenal thing. He said like this. We have a principle in Judaism that anything that's ungodly, which means anything that's empty and meaningless, has no eternity. It might cause me spiritual damage temporarily, but that can be cleansed. And when a person passes away, that there's a cleansing process, and there's a journey, and there's support that we give the person who passed away. We say Kaddish, we learn for them, we do things in their memory. It cleanses them of all the rubbish that was there before. But good, godliness is eternal, because it's infinite. God is eternal, and if everything connected that we do that is meaningful and godly is eternal. So we must never be worried that we carry the baggage of the previous reincarnation, because we don't. But we always do carry the good. Everyone does some good. Maybe my previous guy wasn't Shmuel HaNavi, but he was a person that did good. Don't know who he was, but he was a person that did good. Some good things. Everyone does good things. So therefore, that's it. And the same. That's exactly what we're saying here. We need to know the power of creating. And you know, that's also got to do with the mitzvah of counting the Omer. There's a mitzvah now between Pesach and Shavuot. We're almost at the end of it, right? We count the Omer, the counting of the day. And one of the ideas behind that is that we count every day to tell us that we need to count every day, not just Omer. But that's a lesson. We need to make every day meaningful, because a day that you make meaningful is a day that is eternal. That's why by Avraham Avinu, there's a verse in the Torah that says, Avraham was old, Baba Yamim, he was coming with his days. What does it mean, he was coming with his days? It's a funny expression. It means like he was older, but it means coming with his days. It means that he came with each and every day, because he made every day meaningful. So he wasn't just 100 years old, he was coming with all 100 years. In other words, he was coming with his days, because they were all there. A day that is empty is a day lost. A day that is meaningful, that's what he's saying, is a day that is still there. It's eternity. In the book of Tanya, we just learned it the other day, he explains this idea. He says, but why is that? He says, when we do a mitzvah, you light a Shabbos candle, you give a charity, you help someone, whatever the case is, right? It's something done that takes 60 seconds. He said, yes, but the connection to God that he creates comes from a place which transcends time. God is not bound by time. It transcends time. And therefore, everything good thing that we do and every connection we make to that higher purpose transcends the time in which we did it, and therefore is eternal. So those are the four things. Faith, just to summarize, faith, to be careful of indoctrination, to understand our real potential, and understand the eternity of meaning. We talked about emunah and faith, and I want to just, and you know, again, we never ask for suffering, and we always have questions and things like that, but we talked about even God being there in the threat of suffering in ways that we don't understand, but he's there. And I want to just read you something that I just saw. There was an unimaginable tragedy that just happened in Israel, I'm sure you know, where a woman was on the way to the hospital to have a baby, and she was shot or stabbed, whatever the case, right? And they were able to save the son, but he's in critical condition. And the father, I've forgotten his name now, but the father, I actually saw this on our video also, he was explaining this, but then I saw it written up. The father asked the rabbi, and you could do that, he's obviously, the baby cannot have a bris yet because it's going to be a long recovery. Please God, it should be a proper recovery. And with a son, that means there's never a name, but there's a concept in halakha that if the bris is going to be very delayed, many opinions hold, you should give a name before the bris. So what name did he give? So he said that his wife, who passed away now, his wife always liked the name Ravid. Ravid means a present, because a present from God. So he actually didn't like it so much, but was thinking of the name. Obviously, that was the name his wife wanted. So he gave his name to his son by the Torah. They had a call up to the Torah, and he gave the name Ravid Chayim. So present, but Chayim, it should be with life, you know, because... Right. After that, I don't know if you read this, but they found the terrorist. And they killed him, right? And then the commander of the unit that eliminated the terrorists, as they call it nowadays, neutralized or eliminated, right? He came and met with the father of this baby. And the father asked him his name, and he said his name is Ravid Chaim. Unbelievable. But listen to this. In Kikara Shabbat, that's a place near Gula, in the old city, before the old city, there was a guy owns a supermarket, just such community, this the sense of community which we have so beautifully in the Jewish world, right? There's a guy who owns a supermarket, has a supermarket chain, and he was so deeply moved by what happened, and he was shaken by this whole idea that a woman could go out to give birth and never return, so he wanted to help, so he decided to adopt the family and provide them with free groceries for life. What's his name? His name is Eyal David, but he's the son of Chaim Ravid. So there's no such thing as the email ends here. There's no such thing as incident. Hashem has a hand in everything. It might not be what we want. It might not be the experience we're looking for, but he's always there. That's faith. Have a beautiful week, and next week don't forget Shavuot. Try and connect to Shavuot. If you can go to shul, hear the Ten Commandments. That's a very important thing to do. And we'll see you next Thursday.